Johnson.
Here.
Lomer. Hillstrom.
Here.
Beckerfoon.
Here.
Considine. Dean.
Here.
Frankie.
Here.
Grossel. Howell.
Present.
Lucero.
Here.
Neuberger. O'Neill.
Here.
Pinto.
Here.
Rubin. Ward.
Here.
Zerwas.
Here.
Representative Rubin, have you had an opportunity to review the minutes from April 10th?
I have, Mr. Chair, and they look fabulous. I make a motion to approve.
I should say instead of April 10th, it was March 25th.
Close enough.
29th.
29.
Definitely needed a week break. I hope everybody had a good time. All those in favor of the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. Representative Christensen, are you ready for your present your bill? Chair will move House File 3203 to lay over for possible inclusion. Representative Christensen, welcome to the committee, and you may introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative Drew Christensen. I represent Burnsville and Savage. Mr. Chair, members, House File 3203 addresses something of a loophole in Minnesota state law that we've seen a number of instances over the last 12 years or so of teachers having inappropriate sexual relationships with students that prosecutors are unable to prosecute due to the students oftentimes being seniors in high school who are already 18 years old. So this bill would make that illegal. It'd make it a criminal sexual conduct in the third degree. I do have an amendment, Mr. Chair, which I apologize was late. If we don't have time for it, that's fine, but we can talk a little bit about that. It just kind of cleans up the language and was brought from the county attorneys. And, Mr. Chair, I also have someone from Dakota County Attorney Jim Backstrom's office. Several of the cases have happened in Dakota County to talk a little bit about what's happened in Dakota County and about the bill.
So, Representative Christensen, since this is a DE amendment and you're just presenting your bill, I'll move the DE1 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Motion opposed. Motion approved. Go ahead with your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have someone from Dakota County, from County Attorney Jeff Backstrom's office, to talk a little bit about what's happened in Dakota County and about the language of the bill.
Please welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Philip Kopowitz. I'm the Chief Deputy Dakota County Attorney, appearing on behalf of the Dakota County Attorney, Jim Backstrom. This bill basically addresses a situation that, by not common, does occur from time to time. It's a situation where we have a teacher or a school employee who engages in sexual activity with a student at the time that they are a student at the school. And some situations, under the current bill, it limits it to 17. However, we do have students that are 18, and we also have students with special needs that will go on to school up until age 21. And it's a situation where, under the current law, we would, if you're 18, you can give, it's a matter of consent, voluntary consent. That would not be an offense. We've had a couple of occasions where this occurred, either a teacher or, in one instance, it was about the coach, involving a student who had already turned 18 years of age, and therefore we could not move forward. It's our position that this type of conduct, when you have a teacher relationship, a position of authority, or at least when you have these ongoing relationships that's necessary for us to proceed in these situations, this bill would address that type of situation.
The members have any questions? Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to maybe just confirm this, that I know I feel like in earlier versions of this issue that I've heard, there's been discussion about having sort of anyone who's working in the school have this applied to. I just want to make sure that it really is still limited to an employee or someone who is in a position of authority. So you still have that check, and it's simply extends the age of the person, of the victim in the case, but you still have to check that the perpetrator does need to be in a position of authority in order for this provision to apply. Just want to clarify that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, that is correct. Position of authority, even though they may be either a volunteer or a contract employee or a teacher with the district, you still have to have a position of authority over the student.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that this has been something the County Attorney Baxter has worked on for some time. I appreciate his work and the Chief Deputy's work, and of course, Representative Christensen. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and supportive of the bill, and wanted to thank you for bringing this forward. I think it's important to bring this up, you know, that in any of these situations where we have, you know, an uneven power dynamic, and especially when we're dealing with young people, you know, our media and our culture tends to not speak about these things in the way that, you know, a lot of times it's, oh, a teacher had sex with a 16-year-old, or, and I appreciated the way you described the bill in that, you know, when one of the parties can't consent, there's no sex with happening. It's these are young people that are potentially being victimized by people who are in these positions of authority. So I just want to thank you for bringing this forward. I think it's a good loophole for us to be closing. So thank you.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Deputy Perkopowicz. It's been a while since we've talked. I appreciate your being here, and I appreciate the opportunity to look at this bill. Just a clarification for me, you talked about certified staff, volunteers, or contractors. Is this including non-certified staff? I'm thinking of bus drivers, custodians, anyone else, and particularly when we're talking about vulnerable young adults. So does that include them?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is correct. It would include bus drivers. It would include volunteers, as long as they have that position of authority over the child. So if you had a volunteer coach, basketball coach, who had a position of authority over that student, it would include that individual as well.
Okay.
Representative Ward?
Thank you. Just, again, I'm thinking of those that we might not think of as authority figures with a student, the custodian or a paraprofessional from another class where they really weren't normally connecting with that student? Any adult?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, it would include that type of individual. We have to look at the duties and responsibilities of that particular position. For instance, a lot of employees or contractors or volunteers with the school district do have position authority responsibilities over the care and welfare of that child during school activities, classroom work, volunteer assisting in the classroom, and that type of thing. So it would cover the custodian, it would cover potentially the bus driver, it would cover the para, non-certified employees.
Any public testimony on this bill? With that, I will lay the bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Representative O'Neill. Wish to move the bill to possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have an amendment, Mr. Chair. The A180740.
Everybody had an opportunity to check the amendment to just to explain it real briefly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the amendment deletes some obsolete language about rulemaking. It also changes, make sure that the only offenses included are those that are alcohol-related, and so it eliminates all of the drug offenses from requiring to be used or requiring to use ignition interlock. Kind of doesn't make sense to have drug offenses you can't pick up on ignition interlock included, and so those are excluded. The other change is it brings back some 2011 statute that repeat drug offenders would have a hard revocation period. It would be 90 days for those that had a test failure and 180 days revocation for test refusal. So that is the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Representative Holston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative O'Neill. So currently there's an incentive for folks to come in, plead guilty to their offense, get on ignition interlock so that they can more quickly get their license back. Are you saying that that takes away that provision and that now it will just be a hard revocation period no matter when you come in and resolve your matter from the date you plead guilty, is that correct, or sentencing?
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Pastor. So, no, this is only for those that have drug offenses, not alcohol-related offenses. So that would be going back to the hard stop, basically, of the license, where you could get a limited license after 90 days or 180 days for drug offenses, not alcohol offenses.
Thank you.
And I believe this matches the amendment that was put on a couple years ago as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this mirrors the language that was presented in 2016 but didn't make it all the way through. So.
All right, please proceed. All those in favor of this amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the whole bill. So we've been having a lot of conversations, members, about safety. We talked about distracted driving. We talked about other things involving safety on the roads. And this would be yet another tool in the toolbox for law enforcement and to keep our roads safe. This would require ignition interlock after the second offense in 10 years or the third offense in a lifetime for those that have alcohol-related offenses, as we just excluded the drug-related offenses while driving. And it's really important to note that about 85% of drivers that have repeat offenses either choose to not drive at all or they choose to drive with a revocated license. So we're talking about people that are still driving after drinking and aren't safe. So this would require them to use ignition interlock, keeping the roads safer. The other part of the bill that I think is really important, especially from someone that is a strong advocate for specialty courts, is it would take the driving after revocation and the DWI second offense in 10 years or third offense in a lifetime. It would take it off the payable list. So you'd actually have to go in front of a judge and talk to them. It's a great deterrent. We've seen that in specialty courts. And so I'm very, very excited about that part of it as well. It does cost a little bit, so you do have a fiscal note. There's 5 FTEs that are added, a judge unit, and a couple additional staff to process that through. But I think it's well worth it because it actually is a really great deterrent to do that again. And I've seen in specialty courts, it is a really effective tool. So that's the basic nuts and bolts of the bill. And I do have a testifier if you have additional questions.
Thank you. If you're a testifier, if you could please state your name and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ed Cohen. I'm one of the owners of Smart Start Minnesota, and I'm here to testify favorably for the bill presently before you. This legislation is important to address some of the shortfalls in the use of the statewide ignition interlock program. Mothers Against Drunk Driving has publicly advocated for many years for the increased use of ignition interlock to address public safety concerns about the serious problem of drinking and driving. Mad has had as part of their campaign to eliminate drunk driving the increased use of ignition interlocks since at least 2006, and frankly before that time as well. Their campaign lays out a very strong case for requiring the use of ignition interlocks and why ignition interlocks provide a very strong public policy backbone for legislation of this type. In short, ignition interlocks save lives because they take the instrumentality of the offense away from the driver. In a study commissioned by the Department of Public Safety that was released last year, the study found that while the use of ignition interlock provides a strong public safety effect, the use of ignition interlock remains very low. This study showed that participation rates for the groups of DUI offenders who would be subject to this bill are only 14.5%, meaning that over 85% of the people who would be subject to ignition interlock are choosing not to participate in that program. This bill, as Representative O'Neill laid out, would require that all offenders who receive a DUI for a second and 10 offense or third in a lifetime would have to participate in the ignition interlock program before they could be relicensed. As the study commissioned by the Department of Public Safety shows, there is a very strong anti-recidivism effect of having the ignition interlock on their car. The study showed that that non-participants, people who do not participate in the ignition interlock program, reoffend at over twice the rate of those who complete the program. And so completion of the program is a very strong indicator for lower future DWI offenses. In short, this is a very good bill that will provide a very strong public safety effect, and I can certainly answer any questions that any of you may have about how this program works or anything related to it.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd kind of like to put in plain language so folks understand when it is that you'd have to now get ignition interlock that you don't have to. So if you have a DWI in the past, would you, if you then got a ticket for driving after revocation now, would you then be required to get ignition interlock, whereas before you would not have been? Or could you kind of explain who's in the group that's going to have to get ignition interlock that right now doesn't have to?
Mr. Cole or Representative?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilstrom, today, a driver who gets a second DUI in 10 years or a third in a lifetime can wait out their time period. They don't have to do ignition interlock today, and at the end of their revocation period, be it 1 year or 2 years, they can reapply to get a license. Under this bill, they would no longer have that option of waiting it out. They would have to do ignition interlock. And does that answer your question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that answers part of the question. So it would be people who get DWIs going forward from the date of enactment, or it would be people who get their driver's license revoked going forward that had a DWI in the past, or who exactly gets impacted?
Mr. Cole?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilstrom, this would apply to anyone moving forward who picked up an offense that fell within the described offenses, which are second and 10. So if you had a DUI 9 years ago and you picked one up the day after enactment, you would be subject to this, or a third in a lifetime.
So, Mr.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's only new DWI convictions.
Mr. Cohen?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilstrom, it would be new license revocations would subject you to this, not the convictions.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's new driver's license revocations due to a new alcohol-related offense.
Yes.
yes.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I understand this is an attempt to get folks that before, so they that haven't got their license, they got revoked, to try to get them to comply with an interlock system. The question is that I have is that if they're not participating now and they're driving without a license, how does this get them to comply and not just drive without a license.
Representative O'Neill or Mr. Cohen?
I think Mr. Cohen will answer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howe, I think the goal of this statute would be to that by not providing just a finite period of time before you can get your license back, that it would force compliance with those who are interested in driving legally. So those who get a DWI, who choose to not participate today, they can get their driver's license back in 12 years. It means, not 12 years, 12 months. So instead of what we have today, which is 12 months of somebody looking over their shoulder without an ignition interlock device preventing them from drinking and driving, you have a situation where you won't be relicensed until you've completed this program unless you fall into the group of people who are exempted from application. So it's going to strongly encourage people who would otherwise want to get back to legal driving to participate in this program.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the other thing that we have to remember, too, is this is a piece of the puzzle. We have other members that are bringing forth bills to increase the penalties for driving after revocation, and I look at this as one piece, and there are other members that are bringing other pieces as well.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know we've had this discussion, and we've talked in my office, but I do have an issue with this, and we've talked about the reliability of it, but I had a constituent in December of this year that blew into her device, vehicle doesn't start, has it towed to the interlock company. They say it's her battery. She spends $135 for the battery, spends $150 for the tow. Before this is all done, she's got, and it wasn't the battery, it was a piece of the device. Before she's all done, she's got well over $300 into this deal. And I just got issues with that. And you say the reliability is 99-some percent. Well, here's a young lady working two waitressing jobs, and she's shelling out over $300. And your company, I get it. You pay when you pay for the toll, you pay for fixing that piece of your equipment. Well, I'd be much satisfied in voting for this if you put that in the bill and required all companies to do that. Because I have an issue with a constituent that's trying to do things right, gets the interlock, and then for no fault of her own has to shell out an extra $300, over $300, to try and get back on the road to just get to work. And so that's, and in many of my district, you don't have the capability of calling Uber or calling or mass transit or any other way, you're stuck. So I guess, there, I vented. Thank you.
Representative Hellstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We also have had a conversation in my office. I represent a district that has high poverty rates, and if you can't afford ignition interlock, you can't even wait out the time period. And there is no guarantee that you will be able to get someone else to pay the bill. You can apply and get a reduced price if your income meets it, but if you can't meet that income threshold, you can't get ignition interlock if you can't afford to pay for it. I believe my district now has 98% free and reduced lunch, and so if parents are in a position where they can't afford to feed their kids' school lunch, it's not likely that they're going to be able to afford $100 a month or even $75 a month for ignition interlock. So what this bill does is says, now you can't just not drive for 2 years. Now you can't ever drive, or you have to drive illegally unless you can pay the ignition interlock. That's what this bill does.
Any public testimony on this bill? Okay, with that, I will... you're hiding behind the elevator. Welcome to the committee, and if you could introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning. My name is Gina Calistro, C-A-L-I-S-T-R-O. I'm the vice chair of the Public Policy Committee with MAD Minnesota. Thank you for allowing me to give you a brief testimony, and I will make it brief. I'd like to respectfully disagree with Ed Cohen's testimony regarding MAD's position. MAD Minnesota, 4 years is in support of an all-offender admission in Iraq law. 31 states have made that possible. That is our position. I find it interesting, you know, current trends do not support baby steps to fight this fight. Most of you recognize me. I've told my father's story from Easter Sunday, 2009, how my parents were hit by a drunk driver, a repeat offender. I won't tell the story again because I see a lot of familiar faces who know my story. Next year will be the 10th anniversary of my dad was a Minneapolis police officer's death, and I'm not going to stop. You're going to keep seeing me until something happens. We're not making enough movement forward. We're just moving the needle a little bit. I find it interesting of that testimony because the National Coalition of Admission and Manufacturers does support all offender. So thank you for this opportunity to just give my opinion.
Thank you. Representative Constantine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At one point, do we revoke it for life? I think most statistics say for every time you get a DWI, you've probably driven 10 times where you didn't get caught. So if you're at 3, that's 30 times where you have taken a chance at maiming and killing people on the streets. And while I sympathize with the economics, it doesn't really come close to the people that have lost folks. When you're starting to talk 3 and 4 DWIs, I think it should be revoked for life. And I'm sorry, but again, it's an economic struggle, but if you are killing somebody or, traumatic brain injury or disabling them forever, that consequence is a lot more severe, and they aren't the ones that are drinking. So I really struggle with the idea that we're in a hurry to give them back an opportunity to drive when they have rather cavalierly taken other people's safety and tossed it out the window. So I wanted to rant a little bit to you.
Representative Constantine, I somewhat agree with you, but your 1 in 10 is numbers awfully short. It's much higher than that. Please welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed.
Good morning. My name is Jody Asperson. I'm with the Minnesota Office of Traffic Safety. And I just wanted to address the lifetime revocation piece. The issue with that is these people still drive illegally, whether they're revoked or not. They're going to drive illegally. They're going to continue to kill. As far as the price of the interlock, it's a small price to pay for people's lives. And not just the people's lives, but the people that are injured severely and have lifetime medical bills. We have to remember the victims of these crimes that these people are committing. I understand that it costs them money, but it's also costing the victims a great deal of money for loss of jobs, loss of the ability to function, and their families are burdened with a great debt. So I just wanted to address the fact that I understand there's a lot of talk around the country about lifetime revocations because a lot of people think that's the answer. It's not. You know, interlock saves lives. We've had evaluations that show that it saves lives. All offender has shown that it saves lives across the country and it reduces recidivism. So I just wanted to put that out there because I know there's been discussion about that, and it's not the way to go. It's not going to save people's lives. It's going to end up killing people.
Representative Hesper?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I actually support all offenders. I just support us having a method to pay for it so that we can make it so that people can actually get it and then pay it back as part of their restitution or whatever. Do most states have pools where folks who can't, that have all offenders, where most people that can't afford it have the ability to get the ignition interlock and then pay that bill over time as they need it so that they actually are driving only with ignition interlock?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, states do it all differently. Illinois adds a $30 fee to everyone that is able to afford the interlock, and that actually pays for their interlock program and it pays for their indigent program. The state of Washington charges the interlock providers. They collect a fee, and then they pay that back to the state. That helps pay for their indigent. So every state has it a little different. State of Minnesota has a program where if you qualify, you pay $40 a month, which is extremely cheap compared to transportation, especially out in the rural areas where they don't have transportation. They're able to drive legally for $40. Our office also has a judicial interlock program where we supplement the cost for those that don't qualify for that program but still can't afford the interlock. So there are options out there for people. I just don't know that the courts are aware of it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there any states out there that require the manufacturers or the installers to actually pay for the maintenance of their equipment to keep those functioning? Yeah. Or is it always up to the company to make their own rules and it's up to the person that's bought the interlock to now to buy the extra pieces and parts to keep this thing through working?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not aware of any company in Minnesota that requires that they pay for pieces of it. If there's a fault of the company's product, that company in Minnesota usually does take care of paying for that.
Representative Howe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the key word there was usually. So do they pay for the toll? I know this company here does pay for the toll and pays to keep their equipment up, but it doesn't sound like that's for all companies. So, I mean, if the vehicle doesn't start because of a fault of the equipment, why shouldn't the company pay for that toll and pay for the repair of that piece of equipment? I guess that's where my get. We're going to sit here and require all of these devices in all of these vehicles, and I don't have a problem with that. I think that's a good idea. I'm just saying, if we're going to make that requirement and they're going to get all of these sales, let's put the onus on them for the toll and the equipment maintenance and to make sure the thing works as these people are paying for the product and paying to do that. If that's the case and the way it sounds, these things have got an unbelievable success rate as far as being reliable, that dollar amount should be very small. I tell you what, I could vote for everybody getting one if we could make that happen. But I have a problem when you have somebody that, I mean, all offenders to have one. But that's where I think that if these things are so reliable, the cost of the manufacturers and the installers, that would be so small. I think that would be a small price to pay as we're going to make all these things. We're going to sell a lot of, we're going to put a lot of these in cars on the second-time offense, I think, even though we shouldn't have second-time offenders. But I think that way we would fix part of my angst with putting that many more out there.
Representative Pinto?
Thanks. This is taking us kind of far afield, so I'll be really quick, but I just can't resist asking, has there been any discussion nationally about having this be equipment that would be, like, standard on cars that then you wouldn't have to install, because it seems like you could just imagine that then it's something that would be built in and then it gets activated when it's necessary if the person. So, has there been any discussion about that nationally? I'm just curious. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto. Yes, actually, there's a project, it's called DADS, and it is all the auto manufacturers are working on putting an interlock device in cars once they're, they used to say 2020. I don't know if that'll happen or not. But it actually was a built-in interlock where in the steering wheel, the one that I previewed, in the steering wheel, it would capture the breath of the person, and they would be able to use your fingerprint because it only takes 3 seconds to pull the alcohol content off of your fingerprint after 3 minutes when you press the start button, and that would stop the car from starting. Right now, the alcohol set point is at 0.08 that they're working on, which for the ignition interlock, it's 0.02. But, yes, they have been working on that for many, many years. And I have seen a car that they've been using to demonstrate it. So eventually, many, many years down the road, we will have that. Everybody would have it. and it's not something that you would even notice, the way they built it into the car.
Mr. Chair, we may be driving this by then, I suppose, by the time that comes. We'll see. Anyway, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Neill, any final comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the robust discussion, and we will take all those things in consideration, particularly about what Representative Howe is concerned about. And I guess I'm also kind of curious how many folks on the committee would be supportive of first offense. I'm not sure. I know Representative Hellstrom is supportive of first offense. I don't know where everybody else is at, but that'd be something that we can maybe talk about offline. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for moving this forward.
Thank you. And with that, we'll lay the bill over for possible inclusion. Representative Lucero. Representative Lucero, we'll start with House File 3209 and be laying that over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Chair, members, House File 3209 attempts to address a problem, a potential loophole in current state law. So, current state law under 6009.891, it is a crime to penetrate a security system in order to access an IT system. And one of the things when I was a college teacher, one of the things that I would often have conversations about or include as part of the discussion was those activities that occur in the physical realm, which there might be years, decades, centuries, or maybe even thousands of years in certain circumstances of precedent in how to deal with potential crimes in the physical realm, but then those exact same activities occurring in the digital realm. And one of the examples that I would use would be the crime of theft. So going into a convenience store or a grocery store or any other private property, stealing that property, most would agree, and when I would throw this challenge out to my students, would agree that it obviously is a crime, and it's theft, and it should be punished. But then, this was back at the time when we had the Napster and downloading of music online. It all of a sudden, that exact same activity of obtaining somebody's proprietary content without paying for it, it becomes fuzzy, right? The students and others that I would have conversations with couldn't clearly state that that was wrong. And another example, and for the case of this bill, is we have a crime of burglary. So in the physical realm, we would lock our front door, for example. And if somebody bypasses the security mechanism, the deadbolt on the lock, on the door, to gain entry into a residence, clearly that's a crime. And that's what we have in state law in the digital realm, is penetrating a security mechanism to access an IT system. Now, in the digital realm, a security mechanism might be a firewall, encryption, or credential set, username, password, something like that. But in the physical realm, if that door is not locked, or maybe accidentally left open, or there's been cases when I've accidentally left my garage door open overnight, and I wake up the next morning and come to find that I left my garage door open. That doesn't mean the fact that my door was unlocked or my door was open that it permits somebody to engage in activity of coming into my private property. But so what I'm attempting to do here in state law is, in the digital space, in the absence of a security mechanism, that it is also a crime to gain unauthorized access if a firewall isn't present, if potential information isn't encrypted, or many of the other security mechanisms in place. Now, I will fully admit up front, and which is why I want to get this issue out here, that there are likely unintended consequences for the language at hand. That's why I want to put this out here for discussion, and those that are prosecutors would help improve this bill. That's the intent here. One of the potential unintended consequences that's been brought to my attention that I'm happy to include as this would move forward potentially would be a minor, so a parent minor situation, right? I want parents to obviously still be able to gain access to systems. That's not the intent of this bill. Another would be Well, there's several examples, as we can probably imagine. But anyway, Mr. Chair, members, they're out there, and I know that there will probably be unintended consequences, so thank you.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Sarah, last legislative session, Kurt Delt, Speaker of the House, was running around the House floor to anyone who left their laptops open and sending emails to members as if they were that person. And one of them included email saying, I'm trying to get over my fear of being hugged. Will you please come up to me and hug me? And so members were hugging another member because there was this fake email that was sent out by the speaker. So would that now be a crime of a misdemeanor for the conduct of accessing a member's computer on the House floor and sending out an email as them without their consent?
Representative Lucero?
You're asking me for what my feedback would be?
Yes, would that now be a crime if this becomes law?
Certainly could be. Certainly could be.
Aye.
But again, Mr. Chair, I want to throw out there, again, I look for the experience of prosecutors and others to help to refine this and to get to the intent of what I'm getting at. And so if there are some unintended consequences potentially that we don't want that, right, let's look to improve language as we continue in our need to update our statutes as the digital realm continues to expand into multiple areas of our life and become more prevalent.
Representative Pinto.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll take on the challenge to explore for a minute or two anyway. So let me ask, is there a definition of personal data? Maybe I'll ask that first, that you're looking to. I don't see one in the bill unless I'm missing it.
Representative Rousseau.
Mr. Chair, I don't think that personal data has been defined in the bill, but that definitely is something we would look to do.
And Mr. Chair, one of the reasons I ask is, so if the person, so there's the analogy to, you talked about somebody going into your garage and not taking anything, then that's the crime of trespass. If somebody takes something, then it's a crime of theft. It's interesting, I guess the other term that's not defined is access. And I was thinking, so imagine that, you're the proprietor of a shop before computers, maybe even now, and you have a book where you keep all the information about your business. Now that's actually not personal data, it could be personal data, but I suppose maybe that's another point I might toss out is you could imagine there being some real concerns about there could be data that would be very important to somebody, and there might not be personal data. Anyway, so you have a book that contains information on a business, or maybe even personal information. If somebody looks in that book, they've accessed, and the book's not secured, they've accessed that book, they've looked at it, they probably went someplace they weren't allowed to, so they were trespassing. They haven't necessarily, though, left, I guess the data's in their head, they haven't necessarily, if they take pictures of it or something, just try to analogize, if you understand what I'm saying, because I guess with the analogy, it makes sense to me if you take the information in some way, you load it onto a disk or something, that feels different to me than looking at it, although probably looking at it should be a crime as well. Can you just maybe comment on those points and let's sort of see what you have to say? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair,
Before you start, though, Mr. Johnson has found a definition for personal data.
Mr. Chair and members, there is a definition for personal data in Section 609.87. There are several definitions that apply to the computer crime statutes, which does include this Section 609.891. Subdivision 14 says personal data means any computer property or computer program which contains records of the employment, salary, credit, or other financial or personal information relating to another person.
Great,
thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, Representative Pinto, what I would just emphasize that it is currently, so the activity you just, the scenario you threw out there, it would currently be a crime under current statute if there was a security mechanism that was bypassed. So let's say they did brute force the user or the password to be able to access it. If they're remotely, they're not physically standing in the store, if they remotely bypass the firewall somehow and access it, clearly it's a crime. It's a current law. But if a business owner or a private citizen misconfigures their firewall and it's open. That exact same activity right now, you haven't bypassed necessarily a security mechanism. The exact same behavior might be permissible, if I understand this, right, statute. Likewise, if you're standing, if you're physically in the room and the computer's left open, as the scenario that Representative Hillstrom brought up, if the computer's open, that's not necessarily an invitation to come in and perform mischief.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I guess just one thing to clarify. I think based on my reading of your bill and then the definitions, because I know Mr. Johnson provided the definitions, I think that actually if you have a computer security system that's not configured properly, that probably would be a violation of the current law, because I'm looking at the definition of computer security system in Subdivision 11, in 609.87, says a software program or computer device that is intended to protect the confidentiality and secrecy of data. I think if somebody presented that case to me for charging, and if you had a system set up and you didn't configure it properly and somebody penetrated it, they penetrated a computer security system, even an ill-configured one. But I take your point, though, that regardless, it could be you just leave it unsecured without a security system, you should have the right to not have somebody access it. And I do not see a definition to penetrate a computer security system. I don't know if Mr. Johnson's aware of the definition of that in the statute. He's shaking his head no, so I'm guessing not.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, I'm not aware of a specific definition for that.
Okay. And then obviously, that Representative Sir, so I understand what you're trying to do, and I think that it does make sense that there's an area that we should be going into, and I guess I agree that there probably are some details that just need to be nailed down, but I appreciate you on making the attempt and happy to continue working with you on it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pasadena.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my concern is that under number one, I think my 12-year-old granddaughter would be a criminal, and under number two, the 4-year-old would be a criminal. They come over, they go down, get on my wife's computer, and access games and different things. A 12-year-old knows the passwords and stuff, and the other one just gets, when it's open, she just goes to the different art projects and stuff, and yeah, there's personal data on there, and they would both be guilty of crimes.
Mr. Chair?
Representative
Starrow? Mr. Chair and Representative Constantine, did you grant your daughter or granddaughter, or whoever it was you were just referring to, permission to be able to do these behaviors, or is that something you expressly don't want them to do?
Not each and every time, no. I mean, they're allowed to do that, but they show up, they just go down there and do it. I guess we don't every time say you have to ask permission.
Mr. Chair, I think that a reasonable person would say, since you granted permission the first time, there's nothing in this bill that requires permission to be granted each and every time, but that I think the reasonable person test would say that you grant permission to your granddaughter, but that would not fall under the purview of this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a little bit reassuring.
Representative Newberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lucero, this is a good bill. I like the conversation that we're having here, and I think it's one that we should have in the legislature because as we move forward into this digital age, we're going to be confronting issues, and I think it's always good to be proactive instead of reactive. The one question that I have is kind of segues off of Representative Considine's. How would this affect the use of phones? Because if this is all voice over internet protocol, or if you're using everything you're doing, there's no such, very few people have landlines that are hardwired. I have three daughters who are constantly using each other's phones. Unauthorized. And sometimes it's kind of funny. But the point being is how would this, in its current form, and I know it's a broad brushstroke, I get that. And I'm trying not to belittle what you're trying to do here, because you're absolutely driving in the right direction. But this is, the use of phones, how would that fit into this as well?
Representative Lucero?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Newberger. The question I would ask then, in the scenario that your daughter's using each other's phones, there are multiple, my phone is over there, but there are multiple types of mechanisms to lock it. So there's the pattern, there might be a print, a thumbprint or a fingerprint, there might be the facial recognition, there might be a numerical code that has to be typed out. And the question would have been, in those scenarios, are your daughter's phones, do they not have those at all and they're open, or do they know each other's passwords? And if they do, and they're simply accessing each other's phones, then that would fall under current law. Right? So then the question becomes, does current law create an unintended consequence then in that scenario?
What do you have, Hubert?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'll just end with this. Right now, as you're talking, I unlocked my phone. It was my double top secret code. And it's laying here right here. And for the next 10 minutes, anyone who wants to can walk by and use it because it's unlocked. So if I unlock my phone, lay it down, someone picks it up and uses it, ergo, they could potentially fall under the jurisdiction of what you're trying to do here.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Huber, that's exactly what I'm trying to get at, because I would not want somebody to come in now and text as you, access to pictures, browse maybe malicious websites under your phone, under your credentials, because you left it open unintentionally and left it there for people to access is not an invitation to engage in that behavior. So, yeah.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Interesting conversation. I have my phone set on about 30 seconds, so it's annoying to me more than anybody else. But I'm concerned about the Subdivision 2 felony. A person who violates Subdivision 1, Clause 1, in a matter that creates a grave risk of causing the death of a person is guilty of a felony. What would constitute a grave risk of causing death of a person? What are you doing on a phone or a laptop or a system that would qualify as that?
Representative Lucero?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Ward. So Subdivision 2 is current law. The only thing that we're adding in is, so let's look at current law. So if under current law, one penetrates a security system that results in creates a grave risk of great bodily or death, causing death of the person. You know, offhand, in the advent of how we have more of our infrastructure going online or accessible online, so our electrical grid, maybe nuclear power plants, the natural gas infrastructure. Maybe some of our police monitoring the system that they fire. If somebody were to penetrate a security system that then results in the inability for police, fire, or some of our infrastructure that results in the death, I think that's what that existing law is getting after. But if in the absence, if there is a way around where to find an opening without a security mechanism in place, that exact same behavior resulting in the exact same and would likewise have a similar consequence.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chair, just a comment then, that's all the more reason we should be investing in cybersecurity and making secure all of these systems so that people don't have an opportunity to slip in.
Is there any public testimony on this bill?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Alexi Madden. I'm the Director of State Government Affairs for CompTIA, the Computing Technology Industry Association. We are generally supportive of this bill. We appreciate Representative Lucero talking to us earlier. We did submit some red lines for some exemptions, partial to what the good representative said over there about grandchildren and sisters accessing phones, also parents accessing computer of a minor. We don't want any of them to be regarded with a crime for accessing a family computer. The other exemption that we are looking for is software systems. A lot of times when they are fixing a pad or putting a patch on their software systems. They've discovered a flaw in the system. They want to fix a bug. They go in remotely, and there's not necessarily, when you get the updates on your computer and it says, oh, give us 10 minutes, we're 50% done, we're 60% done. We don't want that to be seen as a crime, so anything for a legitimate business purpose is the exemption that we would also be looking for. So Representative Lucero has said he's been open to these changes, and we look forward to working with him, and I thank you for your time.
Any closing comments, Representative Lucero? Oh. Representative Pasadena?
Thank you. I just kind of like the way you've done this, is throwing it open and looking for input. So I just want to say that. Thanks.
Representative Lucero, any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the feedback, Representative Consigne, Pinto, Representative Hailstrom. And, these are, and I'm very much, as I, my opening comments, I want to incorporate in language that helped to improve and achieve the intent of the language. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
All right, but then I will lay over House File 3209 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Next, we have House File 3425 from Representative Lucero. Just a reminder to the committee that we do have the Guardian and Lytton presentation yet to go, along with the OLA's report, and we have two more bills to do yet. So, and if we need to, we will reserve this room for after 5 o'clock tonight. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House File 3425 for possible inclusion.
And I believe you have an amendment for this one.
And, Mr. Chair, I do have a DE amendment, yes. Okay. I would move that amendment.
All those on the DE amendment, all those in favor, to get it in the author's, where the author wishes, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is approved. Go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is on the topic of digital misrepresentation. And I would draw members' attention to a handout that I included, that is included in the packet, and it is from Wired Magazine. And as you can see the date on the top there, it is from December of last year. And I'm going to read just three paragraphs here, and I think it really captures the challenge that we face here in Minnesota and across the country and globally, actually. And this bill is another one that is attempting to be proactive to get in front of technology as it's coming down the line here. So again, I'm just going to read three paragraphs. So earlier this year, a group of Berkeley researchers released a pair of videos. In one, a horse trots behind a chain link fence. In the second video, the horse is suddenly sporting a zebra's black and white pattern. Turning a horse into a zebra is a nice stunt, but that's not all it does. It is also a sign of the growing power of machine learning algorithms to rewrite reality. Other tinkerers, for example, have used the zebrification tool to turn shots of black bears into believable photos of pandas, apples into oranges, and cats into dogs. A Redditor used a different machine learning algorithm to edit porn videos to feature the faces of celebrities. At a new startup called LiveBird, machine learning experts are synthesizing convincing video from one-minute samples of a person's voice. And the engineers developing Adobe's artificial intelligence platform called Sensei are infusing machine learning into a variety of groundbreaking video, photo, and audio editing tools. These projects are widely different in origin and intent, yet they have one thing in common. They are producing artificial scenes and sounds that look stunningly close to the actual footage of the physical world. Unlike other experiments with AI-generated media, these look and sound real. The technologies underlining the shift will soon push us into new creative realms, amplifying the capabilities of today's artists and elevating amateurs to the level of seasoned pros. We will search for new definitions of creativity and extend the umbrella to the output of machines. This will boom, but this boom will have a dark side too. Some AI-generated content will be used to deceive, kicking off fears of an avalanche of algorithmic fake news. open debates about whether an image was doctored will give way to new ones about the pedigree of all kinds of content, including text. You'll find yourself wondering, if you haven't yet, what role did humans play, if any, in the creation of that album, TV series, or clickbait article. So a picture, video, or audio recording used to be considered close to irrefutable proof that an event or activity occurred. But the ability and the confidence to trust our own eyes and ears is being eroded with modern-day technology. So what this bill is seeking to do is the capabilities exist today to digitally manipulate pictures, videos, and audio to create the representation of an event that actually never occurred. The tools to do this will continue to become more readily available down to the common person as an app on a phone. When we get there in a short few years from now, and according to the research that I've seen, the technology is coming where it will be forensically impossible to detect that a photo was digitally altered. And so when the technology is as prevalent as an app on a phone, we put ourselves in a position where, we can't trust, a picture won't be worth 1,000 words, because it could depict an event that somebody engaged in an activity that they never actually did. So that's what this bill is seeking to do, is get proactive. And again, just like the last bill, there's probably, no doubt, some unintended consequences. Looking for feedback, but this is something we definitely need to get ahead of to make it clear that this is not permissible. So with that, Mr. Chair and members, I will entertain questions.
Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's interesting to have this brought to our attention, but I guess I have some concerns about the way that this is currently written, as far as it seems kind of anti-meme. And, you know, there are a lot of First Amendment implications, I think, especially with how easy it is to take a picture, especially, you know, a picture of somebody's property. You know, someone else could take the picture and put it on the internet, and now it's a public photo, and the person who used the photo from the internet to, you know, make a meme or, like, make something funny has no idea that the original poster didn't have permission to do that. And so this is really broad language to deal with the problem that I think you're actually trying to get at. I mean, I'm familiar with sci-fi and, you know, the Blade Runner dystopia may or may not be coming, but so I appreciate, you know, you bringing this to our attention, but I think it just has a lot of negative implications for First Amendment humor, comedy, and people's ability to use the internet as a tool as well.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Lissaro.
And I appreciate those comments, and you're exactly right. That's what the DE tried to do, is take it from my initial language to narrow it down. And the challenge before us then, as this body, is going to be, how do we take the language and make it so narrow and specific, which is what we want to achieve, make it so narrow that it targets those who would take the pictures that would cause somebody to reasonably believe that the picture occurred, whether the activity that depicted in the picture or audio occurred with the intent to harm or defraud, misrepresent, while at the same time excluding the mean example or others that you're exactly touching on. That is going to be a challenge, absolutely, but we need to do something like that, because this technology, so we're going to adjourn as a body here in, you know, a little over a month, and this technology will continue to innovate. And when we come back January of 2019, there's going to be leaps and bounds in the capabilities that this technology is creating. So we definitely need to do something, and I look forward to, again, the feedback and how can we construct language to get at what we're trying to address.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one thing I'm noticing in this, Representative, sir, it does sound like this bill, too, just will require some more discussion. I noticed that it includes both a picture recording of another person or belonging to another person, and I wonder if that might be an area that's worth more discussion. because I think that we have just a gut sense that if there's a picture of us, of the individual, that we do want a certain level of control over each of our own images. A picture that one of us owns, whatever that means, a picture that I took of a situation, let's say, and I suppose that would have the copyright, that I think feels a little looser. It feels like something that we want to be sort of even more protective of the right of we just want to be real careful about bringing, I think, the criminal law into that situation. So I guess I might encourage you, as you continue in this, to maybe be thinking more about that particular distinction between pictures that somebody owns versus a picture that is of a person, or let's say of a person's child, and I have some control over that sort of thing, and kind of make that distinction. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But one quick comment. I'm already starting to think about the political photos from my mailers. I'm already starting to think that I need a release.
Any public testimony on the bill? Well, with that, we'll lay the bill over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Yep.
Next, we're going to have a report from the Legislative Auditor on the Guardian Ad Litem Program. Good morning. Please introduce yourselves, and you can begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Judy Randall. I'm the Deputy Legislative Auditor for OLA's Program Evaluation Division. I want to thank Mr. Chair and the committee for hearing a high-level overview of our findings and recommendations of our evaluation of the Guardians Ad Litem Program. We released this evaluation late last month. As you know, Guardians Ad Litem have an important role in our judicial system. Guardians Ad Litem are assigned to certain cases where a child or children are in a difficult situation. In these cases, guardians ad litem are expected to represent the best interests of the child. For example, if a child is abused or neglected or in the middle of a custody dispute, a guardian ad litem may be assigned to the case. And then the guardian ad litem is expected to go review the environment of that child and make recommendations to the court about the best interests of the child. It's a hard job, and guardians ad litem interact with families when they're in the middle of a hard situation. They're dealing with families when they're especially vulnerable. Our evaluation of the Guardian Ad Litem program focuses mostly on governance and oversight. We did not focus on individual cases. And at times, our findings and recommendations that Ms. Rodriguez is going to present may seem a little process-focused. But I think it's important for all of us in the room to remember, as we walk through our findings and recommendations, the child or the children who are at the center of the services, they're at the center of what the guardian ad litem is looking out for and advocating for. Ultimately, protecting the interests of the child is the reason why the state has established this Guardians Ad Litem program. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn now to Ms. Rodriguez, who is the evaluation manager of our evaluation, to talk more about our actual findings and recommendations. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. My name is Jody Rodriguez, and I'm with the Office of the Legislative Auditor. I'd like to start by thanking the committee for their interest in our evaluation of the Guardian Ad Litem program. I'd also like to acknowledge the other members of the evaluation team, Caitlin Badger and Christina Doan, who are seated behind me. Today I'll be focusing on two of the key findings from our evaluation. First, as of the end of fiscal year 2017, the Guardian Ad Litem program had not assigned guardians to some cases for which they were required. And second, the Guardian Ad Litem board has provided limited oversight and direction to the Guardian Ad Litem program. I'm going to back up and give just a little bit of background about the Guardian program before I dive a little bit deeper into these two key findings. Courts appoint guardians ad litem to advocate for children in certain types of court cases. Children become involved in court cases for a variety of reasons. In some cases, a child's parent may have a chemical dependency issue that affects their ability to care for their children. In other cases, there may be physical or emotional abuse in the relationship between the parent and child. In these types of cases, the court must make decisions that can have a profound impact on the child's life. And guardians ad litem are appointed to advocate for the child's best interests in a court case and ensure that the child's needs are not overlooked during the court process. As Ms. Randall noted, our evaluation is focused on processes and procedures. But those processes and procedures are important for ensuring that the services that the children are receiving from the Guardian Ad Litem program are of high quality. Both federal and state law require the appointment of a guardian ad litem in cases of child abuse, neglect, or abandonment. And in Minnesota, those cases are heard in juvenile court. State law also requires the appointment of guardian ad litem in certain family court cases where the court has reason to believe that the child is abused or neglected. State law also requires or permits courts to appoint guardians ad litem in other types of court cases. In addition, state law provides broad guidelines about the activities guardians ad litem must perform during their duties. Generally, guardians must investigate the child's situation, including observing children in their home and interviewing children's parents and others with knowledge about the case, including teachers or therapists. They must prepare written reports about the child's best interests and submit those to the courts. And they must advocate for the child's interests during judicial proceedings. Now, the Guardian program has gone through a number of administrative changes in the last 20 years, but in 2010, the legislature created an independent Guardian Ad Litem board to administer the program. By law, the program has financial and policy-related duties and is required to appoint a program administrator to carry out the program's operations. At the end of fiscal year 2017, the Guardian Ad Litem program had over 550 staff and volunteer, including about 320 volunteer guardians ad litem and nearly 200 full and part-time employee guardians. Nearly all of the program's volunteers are in Hennepin and Ramsey counties. While volunteers comprise the majority of the guardian workforce, as you can see here, employee guardians manage significantly more cases. Now that I've provided just a little bit more background about the program, I'd like to dive a little bit further into our findings. The first having to do with guardian appointments. As I noted earlier, courts are required to appoint guardians to cases of child abuse and neglect in juvenile court. And the number of these types of cases has increased greatly in recent years. As you can see here, there was an increase between fiscal years 2015 and 2017 of 25%. While the number of these types of cases increased substantially, the guardian workforce increased only modestly during the same period. The Guardian program reporting increasing its workforce by 13% or 22 full-time equivalent staff members from fiscal year 2015 to 2017. Now, as the Guardian program struggled to meet the increasing demands for guardian services in juvenile court, the Guardian board adopted a case prioritization policy. Before the court can appoint a guardian to a case, the Guardian program must first assign a specific guardian to that case. And the board, in this policy, has directed managers to first assign guardians to juvenile court cases involving child abuse and neglect, then to family court cases for which guardians are required, and then to specific other types of cases. Now, in passing this policy, the board was prioritizing assigning guardians to certain types of cases over others for which the guardian is also required by law. You can see the effect this policy has had on guardian appointments. We found that as appointments in juvenile court increase by almost 40% between fiscal years 2015 and 17, they decreased by about 25% in family court. Now, that's at the same time family court filings or family court cases remained relatively stable. We also found that the program had not assigned guardians to more than 500 cases for which a guardian was required as of the end of fiscal year 2017. That means that hundreds of children who the state had determined required an advocate in the court process did not have one at that time. And this may underestimate the number of cases that by law should have a guardian assigned but do not. Several judges we interviewed said that they no longer even request guardians ad litem in family court cases, even if they're considered mandatory appointments, because they know that the program does not have enough resources to appoint them. Given these issues, we make recommendations both for the board and for the legislature. For the board, we recommend that they develop a clear plan for how they can assign guardians to all cases for which they are required. Now, we think that the board has some work to do before they can do this, and we'll talk a little bit about that in just a few moments. For the legislature, we recommend that you consider the board's plan, and that at the same time, the legislature review statutory requirements, both for the cases to which guardians may or must be appointed, and for the duties that guardians are required to do on each case, and determine whether these requirements still meet the state's needs and priorities. Once the legislature has done that, we recommend that the legislature determine the necessary level of funding for the program to follow all requirements that are in law. Now, moving on from appointments, I'd like to talk a bit about our second key finding, which is regarding the board oversight of the program. As we noted earlier, one of the board's responsibilities is to establish policies for the program. But we found that the board has established few standards for guardian ad litem work. For example, the board has not established standards for certain investigatory activities, such as how often a guardian should visit a child, or when guardians should review certain types of documents. The board has not established criteria guardians should use when making recommendations, and it has not set standards for how guardians should document the work that they're doing. Without clear standards, guardians are left with considerable discretion as to how they will go about performing their duties. And in our evaluation, we found that guardians' work varied significantly across cases. For example, we examined the guardians program's data for fiscal years 2016 and 17 and looked at the median number of times a guardian visited a child in the first 6 months after they were assigned to advocate for that child. We found that the median number of visits in that six-month period was 4. But it ranged from, as you can see here, guardians did not visit 12% of children at all during that first 6 months, while guardians visited 7% of children 8 or more times. We also found that without clear standards, the number of cases that guardians were managing at one time varied across judicial districts. Using program data from the end of fiscal year 2017, we looked at the median caseloads for one full-time equivalent staff member. Now, as you can see, median caseloads ran from about 30 in the 8th district to more than 46 in the 3rd district. Now, the reason we found this level of variation in the type of work that guardians were performing and the caseloads concerning is that we felt that it may indicate that children in similarly difficult situations may be receiving different levels of advocacy and services from the program. We also found that the guardian ad litem board has not actively monitored the performance of the program. For example, we found that it evaluated the performance of the former program administrator, who was in her position for 6.5 years, only once during that time period. We also found that although the board has engaged in some strategic planning activities, it has not adopted a strategic plan, nor has it set very many measurable goals for the program. Now, without performing these activities, it's unclear to us how the board was ensuring that the program was providing high-quality services to the children that guardians are advocating for. I'll conclude with just a few of our key recommendations. As we noted earlier, we believe that the board has some work to do before it can provide the legislature with a concrete plan as to how it can meet all requirements in law, including a number of guardians that it would need in order to do that. First, we believe that the guardian board needs to adopt standards for guardians' work. We also think that they should develop caseload standards for guardians. As you can imagine, the more work that a guardian is supposed to be doing on a case, the fewer cases they can manage effectively at once, and therefore the more guardians would be needed. And with that, I'll conclude my presentation, and I'm happy to take questions.
Member, before we have any questions, we'll see if Kristen Trouble can come forward and
good morning.
Good morning. Please state your name and proceed with your response to the legislative audit report.
My name is Kristen Treble-Halbersma, and I'm the program administrator. I have with me our board chair as well, Krista Parkin. Would you like to hear from her first, Mr. Chairman?
Whichever you would prefer.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to comment on the program evaluation of the State of Minnesota Guardian Ad Litem Board. We are appreciative of the objective and thoughtful feedback. In 2010, the legislature established the Guardian Ad Litem Board to administer the statewide Guardian Ad Litem program in Minnesota. Since its creation, child protection case filings have drastically increased. From fiscal year 2013 to fiscal year 2017, child protection case filings have increased 55% statewide. The Guardian Ad Litem program has not been able to keep up with the increase of cases. Now managers and coordinators who are charged with supervising and training are carrying caseloads. Caseload sizes are high, resulting in Guardians Ad Litem being overworked and highly stressed. They are, at times, having to make decisions between visiting children or writing reports, and often have as many as 60 children assigned to them at a time. Our central management staff is only 4.5 full-time equivalents, which does not allow for the adequate statewide support and supervision that would be ideal for a program that employs and supports approximately 517 staff and volunteer guardians ad litem. As the report accurately points out, the Guardian Ad Litem program has not been able to assign a Guardian Ad Litem for all mandatory cases. Federal and state law requires Guardians Ad Litem to be appointed to cases in which abuse or neglect has occurred. This has resulted in a lack of advocacy for children affected by abuse and neglect in our state. The Guardian Ad Litem Board is unable to meet these children's needs given the drastic shortage of resources. Our vulnerable children deserve better. As you are aware, the Guardian Ad Litem Board is currently in the process of addressing many of the recommendations in the report. We acknowledge that board development could be improved and program standards and goals should be developed further. We have begun taking steps to prepare for a long-range board planning process. We have also taken immediate steps over the past several months to address the following. We have assessed the program budget, we have reallocated funding, and implemented financial controls to most effectively utilize our currently available fiscal resources. We have procured a learning management system to allow for statewide tracking of requirements and to provide online learning modules for our mandatory trainings. The system will also provide supervisory training modules that will allow us to provide for a supervisory training track. We have contracted with a Minnesota management and budget consultant to assist in policy governance development, strategic planning, and the development of board orientation. We have established procedures for the statewide collection of complaint data. We have developed a Guardian Ad Litem Board stakeholder subcommittee to determine the best advocacy model for children involved in family court cases. And we have developed a case count committee to further analyze standardized caseload levels. Resource limitations are an issue that will impact our ability and timing to implement some of the report recommendations. Many of the performance measure recommendations will be resolved with enhancements to our case management system. The Guardian Ad Litem Board developed an improved independent case management system after the creation of the Guardian Ad Litem Board. We have many items that we want to pursue that would assist in monitoring work and providing quality assurance. However, at this time, many of them are cost prohibitive. The Guardian Ad Litem Board is committed to addressing the problems identified in this report and to finding solutions to improve the effectiveness of our program to enhance advocacy for Minnesota's children. We look forward to working with the legislature on the recommendations in this report. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, can I add a few comments as well?
You may.
Okay. I would like to thank the members of the Office of the Legislative Auditors for their work on this report and their thorough analysis and assessment of the program. As Chair Parkin pointed out, the board and the program have been working hard to address several recommendations included in the OLA report, many of which were started before the report was finalized. Staff have already begun work with a consultant to assist in policy governance and board development.
Yesterday, the consultant attended our board meeting to discuss the work ahead and assured us that we will address the five key recommendations regarding our board through their work. We have a two-day work session planned for May 9th and 10th to start working with our board on the development and changes necessary. We are taking action to make the changes we can as quickly as possible. Some of the necessary changes will require an increase in our resources. As you will see when I walk you through our budget request, almost all of our program resources have been used for case assignment and advocacy for children, yet we are still not able to meet all of our mandates. Much of our management staff time has been devoted to managing waiting lists for case assignments and responding to public and judicial concerns regarding our inability to assign guardians ad litem to certain cases. In addition, many of our supervisory staff also take cases to strive to provide advocacy for as many children as possible. For the past several sessions, the Guardian Ad Litem Board has requested additional funding. We have not received the full request. In addition, each year, cases continue to rise. We are committed to making the changes to meet the needs of all of the children, but we do need additional resources to do so. The board and the program management find itself in a very precarious position with having to prioritize among our mandated cases and not assigning cases pursuant to a court order. Judges have contacted the board and program management regarding the lack of resources and the effect on the judicial system and on the children that we serve. Issues identified due to noncompliance with mandates and court orders include lack of timely and quality resolution of cases, in addition to a lack of necessary information regarding the children. In the area of family cases, the guardian ad litem is the only individual providing independent child-focused information to the court. As our juvenile cases have risen, the program has decreased the services that we provide in family court. In 2011, we allocated 41% of our personnel resources to family cases. In 2017, it has dropped to only 13%. Over the past several months, I have attended a number of bench meetings throughout the state. I consistently hear about the need for guardians ad litem in family cases, especially when there are allegations of abuse and neglect. We're excited for the work ahead of us, and we're committed to developing the best program possible. The children in the state of Minnesota deserve the very best that we can offer. The children we work with are vulnerable, abused, and neglected, and we are the caring adult representing nothing but their best interests throughout an at times very adversarial process. Our work is essential to ensuring that children's needs are considered and met during their court case. Thank you for your time, and I would be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Okay. Members have any questions? Please have them related to the OLE report, and if you have a budget request come up, we can keep those questions for at that time. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for the OLE.
Go ahead, Representative Constant.
Thank you. Under your recommendations, it says adopt standards for guardian ad litem work. Would this include educational standards and training standards for working as a guardian ad litem? And would those standards be the same for volunteers and employees?
Ms. Randall.
Thank you, actually, Ms. Rodriguez.
Ms. Rodriguez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Considine. That particular recommendation is specific only to the work that guardians perform in the field, so their investigations, for example. We found that there weren't a lot of standards regarding how often they should visit children, what types of documents they should be looking at, how many other people they should be including in their investigation in terms of should they be talking to teachers or therapists or doctors. So that was specifically regarding that. Now, regarding training and qualifications, the board does have minimum qualifications for training, and they do have minimum qualifications for becoming a guardian. We did not make specific recommendations to increase those because we think that there's some work that needs to be done in terms of
determining exactly what a guardian ad litem should be doing on each case before there are questions as to whether those need to be changed. Did that answer your question?
No, not really, but then it doesn't sound like that's what you look into. So, Mr. Chair, then I guess I would go to the director with that same question. Are the training and educational requirements the same for volunteers and folks? And if you could briefly outline what those are, because at one time I knew guardian items were required to have a high school degree. And I believe that has changed starting in about 2011, but I'm not current as to what they are now.
Yes.
Ms. Trebek?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, thank you, and members. The training is the same for the volunteers as well as the employees of the program. We require 40-hour, what we consider a pre-service training, core course, that they need to attend when they are hired or they are brought into the program as a volunteer. In addition, we have 6 hours of ICWA training, Indian Child Welfare Act training, that guardians need to complete within their first year of service, domestic violence training, and if guardians take family cases, we also have 32 hours of family court training as well.
Representative Constein?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Educational requirements?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The educational requirements are, we prefer a four-year degree. However, it can be a combination of degree or education and experience.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gassman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One more question. Now it's slipping from me. I'll have to come back to it. Thanks.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I want to ask just a little more about the assignment of guardians ad litem. From the earlier report and from the presentation, there's the point the board should develop a clear plan for assigning guardians. And I guess I'm confused because it seems like the plan seems fairly clear. So could you just explain just a little bit from the earlier report on what the problem is in terms of assignment other than simply insufficient funding?
Ms. Rodriguez?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Pinto. I think that goes back to our recommendations that we believe there need to be standards for what the guardian is expected to do on each case and therefore how many cases they should be expected to be carrying. We saw a wide variety of the types of investigations that were being performed throughout the state. And so to us it wasn't clear exactly how many guardians they need in order to meet those requirements. If they're only expected to do a small amount of work on a case, then obviously they can probably handle a larger number of cases, and therefore they need fewer guardians. However, if they're expected to do a larger amount of work, then again, they can have fewer cases, they would need more guardians. So that's where we say we need to see a plan in terms of what's expected of all guardians, therefore how many cases can they reasonably handle, and how many guardians are needed in order to fulfill those requirements.
So, Mr. Chair, it feels like that's mixing a couple of different things, though, because there's the question of if a guardian is required to be assigned in a given case, and as I look at the prioritization, it seems like juvenile court cases related to abuse and neglect, family court cases, it's basically cases where there is a guardian is required. That seems like a separate issue than the caseload for a given guardian, if you understand the point that I'm making there. I guess I'm just, for a given case, if there are, if a guardian needs to be assigned but there's no guardian that's available to be assigned, then the board has to, I guess, prioritize which cases get which guardians. Is my question making any sense to you? Mr. Chair, I'll ask that.
Ms. Rodriguez?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, I think the point we're making is that we understand that they need to make decisions in terms of when they have limited resources, they have to make certain decisions. They can make different types of decisions. They have decided that they're going to prioritize certain types of cases, assigning certain types of cases. There are other decisions that could have been made. They could have decided that guardians were going to perform fewer duties on more cases. So all we're saying is that we would like to know concretely what are they committing to providing for the children they're advocating for, and therefore what are the resources that they need in order to commit to providing those resources or those activities.
Ms. Randall?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, Representative Pinto. If I could just also just jump in. I think you're right that these issues are all kind of interwoven, and so you're sensing that from us. And yes, the program has a clear set of priorities, but what that ultimately means is that they are making choices about which required cases actually get the guardians, and so, or the guardians ad litem. So the legislature has said, we think guardians ad litem should, you know, are required to be in place in all of these different cases, and then because of how the work is being managed right now, the program is saying, well, we can't get to all of them, so we're making choices. And so, you know, first of all, we think that needs to come back to you and say, are you comfortable with that? Right? They're making choices about kind of which requirements to follow. And then we think there's a lot of reasons why that's happening. And one is because it's not clear about the extent of the work guardians ad litem need to do. And actually, if I could point you, I think you all have a copy of the report in front of you, but if I could point you to page 33 in the report. I think there's just a really interesting exhibit there that shows some of the variation of the work that the guardians ad litem do. These are two different reports that are submitted from two different guardians ad litem, and you can see on the left side the excerpt from the first report is incredibly detailed and has a lot of information there about what the guardian ad litem saw and did. And the excerpt on the right column, which is significantly narrower, there's a lot less information there. And in some ways that really kind of shows, we think, the difference in expectations and standards. And so we think step one is to make it clear what are the expectations for guardians ad litem, and then figure out what resources are needed to meet all the requirements in law, or then does the legislature want to change where they're required to be. So you're right, they're all interwoven, but hopefully that helped a little.
Mr. Chair, I saw that the, I'm sorry.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members, if I may add a few comments. First of all, we do have some management standards regarding caseload sizes. They have not been formally established and adopted by the board. However, we do have standards that the managers throughout the program have utilized for caseload sizes, which the standard right now is 30 cases. The Governor's Task Force on Child Protection adopted standards for child protection social workers, which are 10 cases. So our standards, although our work is different than social services, our standards are much different as well. The other piece that I wanted to point out is that the work on specific cases is very dependent on the case type as well as where you are within that case. So if it's an initial child protection case, there's going to be more work that needs to be done versus if the case is at an adoption status. So I do believe that there is more work that we can do from a program standpoint regarding standards, expectations, and quality of work. However, we do have some standards in place. The other piece that I wanted to point to is the report. We don't know the circumstances behind that report. I absolutely agree that is not quality work with the report that was on the right-hand side of that exhibit. However, we have had a number of guardians leave the program due to high caseload sizes and the stress of the work and low pay. And so at times, the program is in the position of having to reassign cases. And at times, reports will look like that because it will be a case that a new guardian is walking into and taking over the case for the prior guardian. The other piece that I wanted to point out is that we don't want to be in the position of having to prioritize cases. That's why we're asking the legislature and ask the governor for additional funding so that we have the resources in which to provide a guardian ad litem for each court order that we receive.
Is this your final question, if I can?
Representative, the room is reserved for 5 o'clock, so it looks like we will be here at 5 o'clock now.
Okay, this will be real quick then. I see that the board has convened a committee to assess give recommendations for the rule. I just wonder when will that committee be expected to produce its recommendations.
Mr. Chairman and members, can you repeat your question, please, Representative Pinto?
And Mr. Chair, the question was, when will the committee that's producing recommendations on the rule of guardians ad litem produce the recommendations? Be expected to do so.
Mr. Trouble.
Mr. Chairman and members, we have convened a committee to look at the role of guardians ad litem in our family court cases, and we hope to have that recommendation to the board, the guardian ad litem board, by June or July.
Representative Holstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, members, I want to give a little bit of a historical perspective because I actually put some of the standards and statute on the guardian ad litem board back in 2002 when they transitioned from county employees to state employees, and we professionalized them, and then I was the author of the bill that created the board that currently is in place right now. The guardian ad litems have been the subject of political debate in this body for a long time, and usually it relates to divorce cases and not related to abuse cases unrelated to divorce. And so there was a time back in 2002 when Steve Smith from Mound was the chair, and there was a specific intent to starve the guardian ad litem program to keep them from being able to do divorce cases, because that's where the highest contention is. Then the legislature decided we wanted to put professional standards in the statute, and we created some standards and training requirements. Then the court, back in 2010, I think was the year, decided that it shouldn't be supervised by the Supreme Court because that's where it was under. And we spun them off and we modeled the board after the Public Defense Board. It's to look exactly like it and have the same duties. This body has an obligation to fund the public defenders at a caseload that's manageable, which in many cases we fail to do. And this body has an obligation to fund the guardian ad litems at a caseload which we require them to do good cases, which we fail to do. When Representative Cornish was the chair of this committee in the last budget cycle, he refused to give them the financial increases that everybody else got. Why? Because the guardian ad litems board do hard work and sometimes make folks angry when you work on cases that relate to divorce. Right, when there are highly contested cases, folks sometimes just don't want them to meddle in these kinds of cases. But the legislature has said if there's an allegation of abuse or neglect, we want them to have a guardian. We want someone to be advocating for the children. So a lot of this is on us and not on you. And I just want to acknowledge that. For 17 years, 18 years, my entire time here in the legislature, I've worked on this particular issue. One of the few who has stuck it out with these vulnerable kids. And if we don't provide the funding that they need, it's shame on us, because they can't do their job if we don't give them the money. So I'll end with that, Mr. Chair.
Representative Considine.
One last question, Mr. Chair. I've heard you advocate for children, you advocate for children. Do you take the children's wishes into account when you do so? Do you present those as part of your findings?
Ms. Trouble?
Mr. Chairman and members, absolutely. Yes, we do consider the children's wishes.
And one comment. In 2015, I must have been your predecessor, I met with her. At that time, they were going to a four-year degree and had it on their website. I'm a little disappointed to find out that that has gone backwards. I think the professionalizing the guardian ad litems would be a good thing. Just expressing that. Thank you.
Mr.
Trevor?
Mr. Chairman and members, we agree in moving the program towards more of a professional role. It is a professional role and should be treated as such. Again, it's resource-driven. It's difficult to find guardians ad litem and require a four-year degree when we don't have the resources to pay them what they should be paid for the positions.
Okay. Well, thank you. And we're going to be doing Patrick Garofalo's bill next, and if we can get done by 12:25-ish, we will finish up today. Representative Garofalo.
Yes.
isn't it?
The Representative Garofalo has House File 2751. Layover for possible inclusion. Apparently needs to work on more electrical vehicle spaces because the car must battery must have been dead this morning.
Not quite, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. I'm not planning on moving the A1 amendment. Is that something that you're going to do, Mr. Chairman? Or is that a discussion on that first?
Members, I was looking at doing the A1 amendment because I do have concerns. If you Google electric vehicle car fires, it's surprising how often they do happen, and I have concerns having these chargers up against the building. If there is a car fire, it could actually produce a lot of structural damage to a building. But at this time, I'm not going to offer it. So keep the debate down to a minimum, and we can keep it to the portion of the bill that deals with this committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. As everyone knows, there is now an explosion taking place, no pun intended, in the amount of electric vehicles that are being produced and purchased not only in the United States but across the world. One of the things that we're seeing is that businesses are voluntarily choosing to install electric vehicle plug-in spaces, usually in preferred locations. Number one, this is an incentive to encourage EV owners to come to their facility to purchase products and purchase services. In addition, on top of that, this is a good branding material. It shows people that they're forward-thinking in terms of the technology that we're going to be using for transportation going forward. There's some uncertainty in the area. However, again, these are private landowners who are voluntarily engaged in doing this. You can imagine that when someone with a gas mobile parks in one of these spots, it eliminates the ability for someone to use that energy infrastructure that's been installed, sometimes at the cost of tens of thousands of dollars. This clarifies that to make sure that if the private landowner wishes for there to be the ability to have a citation for someone who's parking in one of these spots that's not designated for a 100% electric vehicle, that they would be allowed to be cited as a parking ticket. Again, it's voluntary. It provides clarity in that measure. And the short answer to the question is, yes, this did happen to me. Someone parked in the spot I was going to use, and I was bothered by it. That's where it came from. But this is it's got a lot of talk on social media about this in terms of EV owners. And again, for those who are traveling across the country, maybe not with my vehicle but with other vehicles, they're depending upon this energy infrastructure to be able to park, charge up, and move on. And when someone just parks in one of these spots and leverages that infrastructure, it does cause significant problems both for the property owner as well as for the person who's driving the vehicle. So there are a couple testifiers, but there was no known opposition to this in the past. So if you want to hear from other testifiers, you may, but I'm happy to take questions, Mr. Chairman. And as always, I appreciate the hearing.
Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one of the things I think that's good about this bill is the ability to put up a sign so that there is, you know, sometimes just putting up the sign, as we talked about with the service animal bill, can be really helpful in avoiding these problems. And I myself have been researching my next vehicle to be an EV, an electric vehicle, and I can tell you as a family is making a decision about whether they want to make the change to an electric vehicle, where these stations are and being able to depend on them being available is incredibly important as you're looking at the range of different vehicles, especially in a cold weather state like ours. Not particularly worried about an electric vehicle exploding or anything at this point, but it is important, and as we see with the Volkswagen settlement funds, that some of those funds can be used to putting in new stations, charging stations. It would really be unfortunate if folks weren't able to take advantage of those just because somebody felt like parking there, or maybe somebody really doesn't like electric vehicles and wanted to keep Representative Garofalo from charging his vehicle or someone else, because the reality is moving forward, more and more people are going to be driving these vehicles. You know, we see the investments that the car manufacturers are making. So thanks for bringing this forward. I think it's a good idea.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question would be for maybe research or even Representative Garofalo. So I'm familiar with the obviously the handicap. where there's force of law and there's a penalty if one parks in a handicapped parking spot. And then I'm familiar with other types of voluntary, private property owners voluntarily putting other types of signs up, honoring veterans for parking spots. I'm familiar with the prescription drop-offs. I've seen expecting mother signs. And so my question is, are there any other signs except for the handicap that you or staff might be familiar with that have a similar penalty, or would this be the first outside of handicap that creates a penalty in terms of a similar type of sign?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lucero, in addition to the handicap parking, obviously there's no parking facilities where the area is designated no parking. If a person is illegally parked there, it can be removed. I don't think like the newborn moms or the veteran stuff, I've never seen there's really no independent verification of that when a person parks in those spots. There's not like a designated plate or a designated newborn mom plate or stuff like that. So I'm not aware of any, specifications that could meet that category where they would have a placard hanging from the mirror of the car, or it would be physically obvious that, 4x4 truck parking only or stuff like that.
Mr. Johnson, have you found anything?
Mr. Chair, members, I believe that there are some school bus parking zones that also have a similar fine and restriction. I'm not aware of any off the top of my head. I can do additional research and get that to you, though.
Thank you.
Hi. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So right at the ones over by my apartment is you've got the handicap, and then you have the electric ones. I'm 63. I have bad knees, and I have an 8-year-old minivan, so I can go park in the back of the parking lot, and this youngster here with his $95,000 car can park right up front and jump into lines, and I can struggle all the way across the parking lot. I find that slightly annoying. And I have parked in the electric slot there late at night when I'm tired. I find it a little annoying that I'm going to be relegated to the back of the parking lot. I kind of like your amendment where you put them in the back, and I would have a lot less trouble with it there. If I get a Bentley or a Rolls Royce, can I get a parking spot right up front too? Just kind of curious about that. Maybe I should just go get a handicap sticker or something, and I can park up front.
To that point, I will clarify, you can get a used electric vehicle for less than $10,000. So it isn't just Teslas and high roller cars that you're looking at. And I would also suggest you look into a handicap parking space.
Representative Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Rothwell, with the ADA signs, the handicap signs, as a building official, I'm required to make sure that they're at a certain spot and the sign is located there and they're striped appropriately. Who's going to enforce this? Is this going to go into the building code someplace or who's going to require this to be done, or is it not a requirement and it's all voluntary and no one really enforces it? And if the sign goes wrong place, then what?
Representative Grapple.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Howe, number one, no, this does not go into the building codes. Number two, right now we have practices in place for everything from parking signage to display warnings in the Department of Commerce with gas stations. The vast majority of our ordinances and regulatory environment are voluntary compliance. I would view this as no different. And Representative Howe, I think an important thing to remember too is that there's no requirement for this. There's no requirement that people have electric vehicle charging infrastructure. There's no requirement that it be located close to the facility. There's no requirement that if someone does park a gas mobile in there, they take it away. It's simply to, number one, raise driver education, and number two, for those places that view this as a problem, that they would be able to be able to cite them. But in terms of the enforcement of this, I would view it as any other parking infraction. In the case of, because this is on private land almost always, what you're likely to have is a private owner calling law enforcement to ask for there to be a citation issued for a habitual offender or whatnot.
Representative Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this sign that shows up that they're going to put up, is that going to explain the possible penalty and violation, or is it just going to be designated and they're going to find out the penalty when they get towed?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Howe, on page 2 of the bill, lines 2.14 through 2.17 would lay out the guidelines for that.
Representative
Howe. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So 169.06, can staff, subdivision 1, can you tell me what that is? Is that just the design of the sign, or is that explicitly lay out what's supposed to be in the on the sign?
Mr. Johnson? Chair members, section 169.06, subdivision 1, simply gives the commissioner the authority to adopt a manual and specifications for a uniform system of signs. So it's the provision that grants them the authority to make the signs in a uniform manner. Representative, this question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that, what that does is that says the brush stroke and the size of the lettering and okay, thank you. So it doesn't say what's supposed to be on there. Thanks.
Any public wish to testify on this bill? Any final remarks?
No, just a good bill. I'd ask for members' support. And if people have any questions, let me know. On a side note, my car did not cost $95,000. that's it.
Well, thank you. The bill will be laid over.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
And we'll have the guardian ad litem budget request.
You can do that now, too?
Yes.
You didn't give it to him?
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
Ms. Trouble, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Hopefully we'll try to get done by 12:30.
Okay. I have a brief PowerPoint presentation, and I believe you have my slides as well.
Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Again, my name is Kristen Treble Halbersma. I'm the program administrator for the Guardian Ad Litem program. I'd like to discuss our budget proposal. In 1974, Congress enacts the Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act, which is called and referred to as CAPTA. This is what mandates or provides for the federal mandate for guardians ad litem in CHIPS cases. In fiscal year 2015, Minnesota received $2.3 million in CAPTA appropriated funds. That funds is received by the Department of Human Services. To continue to receive the federal foster care funds, a state must enact and enforce laws mandating the appointment of a guardian ad litem on every juvenile court case alleging that a child has been abused or neglected. As you heard earlier, we are no longer meeting this mandate. In 1975, the legislature enacts the guardian ad litem statutes in the state of Minnesota, which mandates an appointment of a guardian ad litem on every juvenile and family court case alleging a child is abused or neglected. There's also legislation which allows for the appointment of guardians ad litem in permissive cases.
Since 2015, our program has not been assigning unpermissive cases to prioritize all of our resources for our mandatory appointments. As you'll see with this slide, in fiscal year 16 and 17, our operating expenditures were 15 to 13% of our overall budget. Back in fiscal year 14 and 15, our operating personnel was 70% of our budget and operating was 30%. So you will see that we have decreased our operating expenditures significantly so that our resources are used to provide advocacy for the children that we serve. Currently, our central office staff, the administrative staff for the statewide guardian ad litem program, is less than 2% of our personnel budget. Most agencies of similar size range from 12 to 15%. You'll see on our next slide, we have approximately 200 FTEs, 197.55 currently, and 288 volunteers. So we have just under 500 guardians ad litem in the state. We have some supervisors that have caseload supervision levels of over 350 cases. We rely on one of our managers to serve two roles, one as our database manager and one as our district manager, due to lack of resources and ability to provide funding for both. As stated earlier, many supervisors work on cases as well. And you'll see with this slide the significant increase in our case filings and the juvenile court cases in which our guardians are assigned. We've had a significant increase since 2011. This year, we requested $4 million from the governor in his supplemental budget request. He provided $3.667 million, $4 million in fiscal year 20, and $4 million in FY 21. This request will address the number one recommendation from the OLA, which is providing services on all cases. We're asking for 12 guardian ad litem positions to handle unassigned child protection cases. Currently, we have approximately 362 unassigned cases, which equates to around 500 children. We're at 95.3% compliance with our federal mandate. We are also asking for 11 guardian ad litem positions to lower caseload sizes to approximately 30 cases per FTE. We currently have 42 guardians ad litem that are over that range. When cases are high, it contributes to late reports, and it can impact the quality of work provided because guardians ad litem cannot appropriately work caseload levels that high. When I started in my position in June of 2017, we had some guardians that had upward of 60 cases per FTE. We're also asking for 13 supervisory staff positions to provide appropriate and adequate case supervision coverage. The recommended level that we have established for our program is 200 to 300 cases per supervisor. We would need 13 additional staff to be able to provide for that level. As cases have increased, so has the supervision level, and we have not added supervisory positions in years. The last request is 9.5 guardian ad litem positions to handle unassigned mandatory family court cases. We looked at the level of service that was provided back in 2015 to obtain this number. We believe that this could likely be a low estimate because there are a number of judges throughout the state that are no longer requesting services on mandatory cases because of our case prioritization policy. What has been the increase of the case filings? As we've talked about today, many abused and neglected children have lacked an advocate to represent their best interests. The program, in addition, is unable to comply with state and federal mandates. We have court orders that are not being followed. And children of color are impacted due to the high levels of unassigned children in Hennepin County. We have approximately 250 unassigned cases in Hennepin County right now.
and be open to any questions that you may have for me.
Members have any questions? Well, I want to thank you for coming here. We will consider your requests, and we will be adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.